mid-20th century. Information at cjm.org. Mostly cloudy skies tonight with lows in the 50s with southwest winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, Tuesday, mostly cloudy. Highs in the mid-60s with light winds becoming west around 5 miles per hour in the afternoon. Time is coming up on 7 o'clock. Our next program is City Visions here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco, KALW.org.
Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Next Tuesday is Election Day, if you haven't figured that out yet. And Bay Area voters will face a dizzying array of ballot propositions that address everything from food labeling to campaign contributions. But two of these initiatives, Propositions 34 and 36, are especially important because of their potential impact on criminal justice across the state and here locally. Prop 34 would repeal the death penalty and replace it with life in prison, while Prop 36 aims to reform the state's so-called three strikes law to better target violent criminals and prevent prison overcrowding. Will these propositions save the state millions of dollars in unnecessary legal fees and incarceration costs, as supporters claim? Or will they, as opponents argue, jeopardize public safety and reverse falling crime rates in the Bay Area? And how do these efforts fit into the larger landscape of criminal justice in California, particularly with the recent realignment process, which is shifting resources from state prisons to county facilities? Tonight, we will discuss these questions and more with our panel of guests who sit on both sides of these key propositions. First, here in the studio, we have Steve Wagstaff. He's district attorney for San Mateo. Mr. Wagstaff became the DA in San Mateo in 2011 after serving as the deputy DA for San Mateo for 20 years. Mr. Wagstaff has prosecuted over 30 murder trials, including 4 death penalty cases, and he is opposed to Proposition 34. He is a member of the California District Attorneys Association, which is opposed to Proposition 36. Thanks, Mr. Wagstaff, for joining us.
Joseph, good evening. Thank you for inviting me.
Also in the studio with me is Jeannie Woodford, and she is former warden of San Quentin Prison. She's an official proponent of the Safe California Act, that's Proposition 34, and Ms. Woodford has also served as secretary and undersecretary of the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. And while she was at St. Quentin as a warden there, she oversaw 4 executions. Welcome to the program, Ms. Woodford.
Thank you so much for having me.
And joining us by phone, first is George Gascon. He is district attorney for San Francisco. Mr. Gascon was elected DA in 2011 and after serving as city's chief of police for 2 years. And he has over 30 years of experience in law enforcement and has endorsed both Propositions 34 and 36. Welcome, Mr. Gascon.
Thank you, Joseph. Good evening.
And also by phone, we have Jonathan Simon. He is the Adrian A. Cragen Professor of Law at UC Berkeley. Dr. Simon has been on the faculty of UC Berkeley's Bolt Hall Law School since 2003 and teaches courses on criminal law, criminal justice, law and culture, risk and the law, and social legal studies. He's also a faculty associate of the Berkeley Center for Criminal Justice. Dr. Simon does not have an official position on either proposition. And welcome, Dr. Simon.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great. And as always, we will open our phone lines in about 15 to 20 minutes, and we'll welcome your calls and questions for our panel of guests. You can dial 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134 to give us your thoughts on Propositions 34 and 36. You can also email us now at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com, or you can post a comment at our website. Go to KALW.org and search for City Visions under Programs. So, Dr. Simon from the UC Berkeley Bolt Hall Law School, I wanted to start with you. We're going to dive into each of these propositions quite a bit in this hour, but I want to start with a brief overview of criminal justice in California as it stands today. What are the trends and concerns in criminal justice in this state that have led to these two propositions? So just give us the landscape upon
Sure.
which these propositions basically came to be.
I know, especially at election time, we tend to focus on the very short term, even realignment, which is now about a year and a half old seems old from that point of view, and yet I would suggest it could be helpful to take a long view here and think about how California has developed policy over the last 40 years, and it makes me sound very old, but that's when I came to California to be an undergraduate in the mid-70s, and it was a time of where you essentially had two things going on: relatively small prison population, light sentences, the death penalty was not operational at that point, and we had a lot of crime. I mean, crime began to grow in the 60s, and it basically tripled by the end of the 70s in California. The homicide rate did. So it was a very alarming time. And frankly, people really lost confidence in our approaches to criminal justice in that period. And what you saw really over the next 25 years was a steady march toward penal severity, both a return of the death penalty, the Briggs Initiative in 78, greatly expanding it. Of course, it reached its peak in many ways in 1994 with the Three Strikes Initiative. And what we've got now, Joseph, is really the other side of that arc. Over the last, say, 10 to 15 years, California's been experiencing some very different conditions. We've had a significant drop in crime, as the rest of the country has since the mid-90s. There's more confidence that police can do things that may actually address crime directly, prevent crime. We've also had an enormous expansion of our incarcerated population, which is now extremely expensive to maintain and has also created the enormous medical crisis that brought us to the Supreme Court in Brown versus Plata. And perhaps not surprisingly, over this last decade, really since the start of the new century, more and more propositions on the ballots have been pointing toward leniency or at least new strategies for public safety, drug treatment rather than jails, etc. What's so exciting about this year is this is a continuation of the trend, but we're now reaching issues that many people thought would be off the table permanently, you know, questions of violent crime, what to do with murder. And I think it does really reflect the change, challenges that California faces now fiscally, but also the relatively better crime situation we have.
So thanks for that broad overview there. And it took you till your last statement to make the point that there's a fiscal argument to be made here, and we'll hear more in depth from proponents and opponents of both of these propositions. But in your point of view, how much is the fiscal impact or the proposed fiscal impact should these propositions pass? How much of that is driving this, and how much of it is all the other factors that you mentioned, which is the drop in crime, the confidence in law enforcement, the overcrowding, and other concerns around the state of affairs in our prison system?
So I don't doubt that the fiscal issues have become very motivating, especially at a time when California has gone through such a long period of hardship and at a time when we can very visibly see where we would spend the money if we had it. I mean, we have, you know, three or four murders in Oakland every weekend in recent months, it seems, and we know that our police force there is dwindling in size, and we could really see where we could use the money. So I think fiscal stuff's important, but I think unless two things had happened. One, people felt more confidence that we can deal with serious crime without the exclusive reliance, if you will, on throwaway the key prison sentences and the death penalty. It has opened our imagination to consider alternatives. And then closely related, frankly, a sense of public scandal associated with the project of mass incarceration, which, you know, if you followed the three-judge court and the Supreme Court in Brown versus Plata, you actually had the Supreme Court saying, you know, locking people up doesn't reduce crime when it's so overcrowded and when you're so indiscriminate about who goes to prison.
So let's turn now then to each proposition in turn. I'm going to turn to Prop 34 first, and that's called the Safe California Act. And I'm going to turn to you, Jeannie Woodford, to give us an overview of what Proposition 34 aims to do.
So Proposition 34 does three simple things. It takes the existing law and crosses out death penalty and leaves life in prison without possibility of parole as the harshest punishment in California. It also sets aside a small portion of the savings, $100 million in total to be spent over 3.5 years, for the sole purpose of solving the 46% of homicides and the 56% of reported rapes that go unsolved on average each year in this state. And that's why it is a public safety measure. And then finally, it requires all inmates who are serving life in prison without possibility of parole to work and pay restitution into the victim's compensation fund.
And this change in the law will apply retroactively to those who are currently on death row. I mean, it makes sense, obviously, right? If you're abolishing the death penalty, you can't also. But I want to make sure that people understand that. So it's not just moving forward, it's going retroactively. Is that correct?
Yes, there's 727 individuals on death row currently, the largest death row in the United States. And after we win, yes, on 34, those individuals will be serving life in prison without possibility of parole, which is really what we have with the death penalty in this state.
Say more about that.
Well, you know, since 1978, we've had 13 executions, and we've spent $4 billion on the death penalty, and that number comes from the Alarcon-Mitchell report. Judge Alarcon believes in the death penalty. He's a federal court judge. He and his law clerk, Paula Mitchell, studied the cost of the death penalty at both the state and local level for over 5 years and concluded that we've spent $4 billion on the death penalty. We've carried out 13 executions. And, in fact, more inmates have died by natural causes, a few by suicide, 84 in total. And over 75 inmates have had their death sentence overturned, and they ended up serving life in prison without possibility of parole after years of appeals. So it's very rare, if ever, that we have an execution in this state.
Hmm. And so why do you think Prop 34 is important enough that you would put your name on it like this?
Well, you know, I started at San Quentin State Prison as a correctional officer in 1978. There were six inmates on death row, and a couple of those inmates are still there today. And one died about a month ago of natural causes, and the other three had their sentences overturned. I watched that death row grow to where it is today, and I just know how broken the death penalty is in this state. And I know that it's a burden on victims, and we have over 700 victim family members who support yes on 34, and many of them initially asked for the death penalty and came to realize that it was a burden on them. The years of appeals, it goes on and on for those family members.
So that was my next question to you. Why is it that there are so many people on death row who actually don't end up dying because of the death penalty, but because of natural causes or, as you mentioned, some suicides? So what, just paint a picture for us that I imagine most people know about, but just to explain why that it takes so long for that sentence to come to be.
Well, the trial itself actually takes, in most cases, twice as long as a non-death penalty trial. And Los Angeles is an example. It's over 800 days for a death penalty trial and a little over 500 days for life in prison without possibility of parole. And that's a study that will be coming out very soon. So the trial itself takes a very long time. And then once the conviction is in place, it's about 5 years before the inmate receives an attorney to begin the state appeals process. And then, on average, it's about 12 years before they receive an attorney to do the federal appeals process. So the lack of attorneys, the lack of money to provide attorneys, makes the process go on and on and on. And then many of these cases are overturned for a variety of reasons. So inmates end up going back to trial again. But imagine what that is like for the family members of these victims.
So can I ask you something? Are you opposed to the death penalty, or are you opposed to the way the death penalty is sort of broken in this state?
I've always been morally opposed to the death penalty, having been raised a Catholic, but that's not what makes me passionate about it. I really care about public policy, and I really care about what works. And I know, after studying criminal justice for over 30 years, that what works, what really keeps us safer, is solving crime. And we have this criminal justice gap in this state, with 46% of homicides and 56% of reported rapes going unsolved on average each year in the state. And the majority of that crime occurs in our poorest communities. We need to be very cautious with our criminal justice dollars and spend that money keeping police on the streets. You mentioned Oakland, California. There's a city that needs police on the streets. That's what will prevent homicides and victimization. And so I'm very passionate about public policy that really dictates that our money spent on providing the things that really make our families and our community safer.
And can you lay out for us what you expect the state to save in the short and the long term should this proposition pass?
Well, the Legislative Analyst Office, which is a nonpartisan group who has the responsibility of telling the voters whether a proposition will cost them money or save them money. So they have concluded the state will save $130 million a year. Now, the Alarcon-Mitchell report said we would save $184 million a year. And the difference is that the Legislative Analyst analyst's office looked at state savings. The Alarcon Mitchell report looked at local and state savings. So that's why there's a difference in those numbers.
And then $100 million will be set aside for, is it per year for 3.5 years or total of $100 million?
It's total. It's $10 million the first 6 months following a win on 34, and then $30 million a year for the next 3 years. And the purpose of that money is to really highlight this criminal justice problem that we have in this state, unsolved homicides and unsolved rapes, and to put a focus on it and begin a process of addressing this serious criminal justice issue.
Okay. Well, thanks for that overview. I'm going to turn to Steve Wagstaff, who is your opponent on this proposition. So Steve Wagstaff, just to remind our listeners, is the district attorney for San Mateo. We were just hearing from Jeannie Woodford, who is an official proponent of Proposition 34, and she was the former warden of San Quentin. So, Steve, let's take pieces of Ms. Woodford's argument. Let's start with the last part, which is the fiscal argument. She made several arguments, in the concern being that the system is just really broken, and that there's also that most cases don't actually get to the death penalty, and that the money spent could actually be used to put more police on the street to solve unsolved crimes and such. So start with that, with the fiscal argument. Do you buy the numbers? Do you buy that argument? And then kind of work your way through the other pieces.
Well, it's tough to say, no, I don't buy the argument as to the exact amounts, because certainly what Jeannie just said in terms of what's been reported is accurate. As a matter of fact, just about everything Jeannie said in terms of facts, I totally agree with. Merely the conclusions we draw from them is where we differ. And on the money, we had, as she noted, you had the Alarcon report, you had the $130 million from the legislative analyst. I sat there, as Jeannie did a month ago, listening to the legislative analyst talk about how they arrived at their conclusion. And I heard that analyst say, and every one of us who knows the system cringed when we heard him tell the committee that, oh, and by the way, the people who are on death row right now, their appeals will continue. However, for people getting life without parole in the future, under this new initiative, they won't have appeals and we'll save the money. And we sat there saying, obviously they didn't do their research well enough, because of course they will have appeals. There will be appeals that will go through the state court. There are appeals that will go through the federal courts. And so for that to be a major part of their basis, for their opinion of $130 million, it shows it's flawed. The variance shows it's flawed. Now, I don't for 1 second suggest it won't save money. Of course it will save money. But I am also suggesting that all those lawyers who've been handling the appeals are not about to suddenly say, gee, I guess I better go be a probate lawyer or a contract lawyer. That's not going to happen. So in that sense, no. Where I really fall down on this one, though, where I really press it the strongest from my mind, is that this is a decision that should not be made on the basis of this money, even in these tough, difficult times. And I recognize how tough the times are. We all do in government. However, when we're looking at the cost of this and we're looking at what happens, and you sit there and say they didn't do their research, will it save the money? One of the legislators asked the legislative analyst at this hearing, well, did you go look at one of the 5 states that did abolish it to see what happened in those states? And they said, no, we just didn't do that. We didn't go take a look to see what could be done and what could be studied there. It causes me to say that the financial analysis is not a sufficiently adequate one, and not the basis, in my mind, which this ought to be decided on. When we talk about the $100 million that will be spent in the next 3.5 years, as one looks at it, one says, if it's really the goal here is to save the money and spend it on solving the crimes, the unsolved homicides, the rape cases, then why is it just for 3.5 years? Why is that not just simply a carrot to get people in these most difficult times? And that's what hits me about it. It's just a carrot as opposed to a permanency. The other side of it is I've never been a believer in budget by the ballot box. I think that's not the way we do it. We have a legislative of people. This $100 million, if we did it every year or every 3 years, $100 million, that would mean the legislature and the governor are deprived of the opportunity to decide where do we spend our money. Should it better be spent not on solving these, but on making us something other than the 47th state in education in the United States? That's why, for me, the true issues here should rest on something other than financial.
Okay. So I'm going to get you, Jeannie, to respond to those pieces, and perhaps also we'll get San Francisco DA George Gascon as well. So, Jeannie, would you like to take those pieces? The first is that, you know, the numbers are don't really take into the account what will likely happen, which is that those who are having sentences of a life imprisonment without parole will unlikely appeal them. The second part is that, you know, this isn't taken into account what has happened in other states. And then thirdly, that the 3.5 years of $100 million for unsolved crimes is really just a carrot to lure voters into the ballot box and, you know, and really doesn't go towards this problem long term.
Well, the Legislative Analyst's Office looked at California. They looked at the cost of incarcerating inmates with life without possibility of parole and those inmates on death row. And they concluded that it's more expensive to have inmates on death row in terms of the incarceration cost. And it also looked at the cost of the state appeals process in this state. And that's how they arrived at their analysis. And in fact, in anybody that has a felony conviction can appeal their case. And in the case of life without possibility of parole, those appeals are over in 18 months. When you're on death row, you have a legal team for life. Those appeals are never over until your sentence is overturned or until you're executed. So that's forever, really, and that's why it's so expensive. And we should note that 17 states don't have the death penalty. There's been 5 in the last 5 years, as Steve noted. And then why 3.5 years? Well, a lot of people object to budgeting by the ballot box. But when we listen to the voices of victims, they really wanted us to highlight the fact that we have so much unsolved crime in this state, almost half of homicides. And many of those family members lost a loved one to homicide and they don't know who did it. So the purpose of having it on the ballot is to highlight this criminal justice gap that we have in this state. And then we also know from other ballot initiatives that when the voters say they want money directed to a certain purpose, that happens for a couple of years and then we all forget about it. So it's a really realistic ballot initiative that says for 3.5 years, the savings will go for this purpose. And then we hope that solutions will be put in place that the voters in our legislature will support from then on, because it is important to solve these crimes, because that's really what reduces crime in any state.
And I'm going to reintroduce the program in case you're just joining us. This is City Visions on 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. And tonight we're talking about Propositions 34. That is the Safe California Act that's aiming to repeal the death penalty here in California. And Proposition 36 that is trying to reform the three strikes law. And we have several guests both on the phone and in the studio to discuss the pro and con arguments on these two propositions. We were just hearing there from Jeannie Woodford, and she is a official proponent of the Safe California Act, or Proposition 34, and former warden of San Quentin. And just a moment ago, we actually heard from Steve Wagstaff, district attorney for San Mateo. And on the phone, we have George Gascon, district attorney from San Francisco, and Jonathan Simon, professor of law at UC Berkeley. We're opening our phone lines to you, our listeners, to join our conversation with questions and comments for our guests, 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. How are you voting for this proposition? What questions do you have if you haven't made up your mind yet? And if you've voted already in early voting, please let us know how you voted. 415-841-4134. You can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com, or you can post a comment at klw.org and search for City Visions under programs. So back to you, Steve Wagstaff. Any responses to Jeannie Woodford's comments?
No, it's just we simply have a different perspective on what ought to be done and how it ought to be spent. The only additional point I would note for your listeners is I can only speak for San Mateo County, not another, but in our county, the homicides are not going unsolved for lack of resources. Our agencies are properly funded. We are not suffering from what Oakland and San Jose are. And in our county, the cases don't get solved because witnesses will not come forward. Additional money in our county for homicide cases, that isn't what's going to make the difference in trying to solve the percentage in our county that do not get solved.
And District Attorney Gascon, would you like to step in here with a couple of comments? You're on the record as a proponent of Proposition 34.
Sure, absolutely, Joseph. I think there's another area that hasn't been discussed, and frankly, for me, is probably the most important. That's the whole area of wrongful convictions. You know, the problem with the death penalty is that if you actually execute someone, there is no way that you can undo the harm. We know now that there are significant numbers of people that have been wrongfully convicted around this country. California has quite a few. My own office has two recorded cases of wrongful convictions. So I think that, you know, when we're talking about executing someone, we need to be really thoughtful about what we're talking about. The system is not perfect. The reality is that wrongful convictions do occur. And like I said, even in my own county, we have had a couple of cases. I know that there are some other counties around the state that have quite a few. If you add that, then, you know, we have already talked about the cost, and I know there are differences of opinion between the proponents and the opponents of this, whether it's safe money or not, but then look at public safety. The reality is that there is no death penalty and reduction in crimes. We know that we have compared crime rates in states like New York that has abolished the death penalty against crimes in states like Texas and Florida that are very effective in the way that they handle the death penalty, and we don't see a correlation there. We see, quite frankly, that violent crime has gone down in New York at a much higher rate than it has in Florida and Texas. So we certainly can't say that this is because of public safety. So if it's costly, we have the risk of wrongful conviction, and we have, you know, we really don't have a correlation with public safety, we have to start asking ourselves, why are we doing this?
So back to you, Steve Wagstaff. Thoughts on George Gascon's comments there. The first about the concerns of wrongful convictions, and secondly, that when you look at states that continue to have the death penalty and are, as he says, more efficient at getting that end achieved versus states like New York that have abolished the death penalty, that you actually don't see that the death penalty is actually a deterrent to crime, which I don't know if that was one of your arguments, but I'd like you to weigh in on that because I imagine that's what some people are thinking or asking about.
I think they are, and I've made it very clear from the beginning. I've actually myself argued to juries, do never make this decision on the basis of it being a deterrent. It is an imponderable. We cannot determine whether it deters or whether it does not deter. So therefore, that's not a basis in which a decision on this topic should be made. Instead, it should be made on whether it tried. And that's what George does. George guides it to where, on a philosophical level, whether this is something we ought to be doing and whether we take a chance on an innocent man. Now, in the state of California, and I agree with George very much and Jeannie, there have been people taken off of prison, out of prison, due to the fact of innocence being shown. There has not been such a case in our state from death row. And that doesn't mean it couldn't be. As others have said, Gil Garcetti, former LADA, has said, I can't take a chance that there might be someday. But I know that our governor has said there are, looking at it, there are no innocent people on death row at this point on the cases that he has reviewed. Therefore, the topic for me becomes, is there a punishment that fits the crime? That's what I've argued to the juries when they have returned death is, when you have a, about 3 weeks ago, I made a decision in our county that two young men who had, for gang purposes, killed another person by shooting him after beating him, that they deserve to receive life without parole based on all the circumstances. One victim there. Does that mean that somebody like Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker, does that mean somebody like Timothy McVeigh, the person who blew up the Oklahoma building for $250, gets the same punishment? For me, no, and that's where the decision falls for me, that there are certain cases, those very small percentage, less than 2% of our murders, where death is sought as the appropriate punishment, used judiciously. In San Mateo County, we have sought the and obtained the death penalty once in the last 18 years. I do not agree with counties that decide they're going to seek it all over the place, down in Southern California, perhaps. That's not where I come from. But I do believe in these. The case I last sought it in, a year and a half, 2 years ago, where there was an officer who was shot by the suspect twice in the chest, knocked him down. He came up to the officer and put a bullet in his head and executed him. A jury in my county determined that for that punishment, this parolee deserved to receive the death penalty. I obviously agreed with that in asking for it. That's why I seek that the death penalty continue to exist in our society.
Then I guess the follow-up argument, or the follow-up question, I would say, to that argument is, if the system, I think you agree, is broken somewhat, how could you see a situation in which the process could be fixed and made more effective and efficient?
I do see it. Now, this is where Jeannie and George can call me Pollyanna, and because that might be the right title. But I still believe in good government. I still believe that perhaps people can have the political strength and the political will to try and fix it. Because I agree with Jeannie. It is broken now. There is no way these cases should take the time they do. It is a total lapse of responsibility to the public that said this penalty should exist. And if they do, after next Tuesday, say it should continue to exist, well, then, darn it, it isn't over for me. I continue to say we need to move forward and change this law in a variety of respects to make it better in its enforcement.
Can you give some details on that?
Of course. I'll give you one as an example, what Jeannie mentioned earlier, that it takes that fellow that I convicted, it's now actually 3 years ago in a couple months, he doesn't have a lawyer and he won't have one for another year or so to even start the process. That's an abysmal failure of the system. Now, I want to say, well, isn't that just going to cost money too? Well, yes, but I've got a different approach to it. How about our big law firms in this state? There are some of them who've done very wonderfully who are providing pro bono lawyers to help out in these type of criminal defense cases. Because I want these people to have full and complete appeals. But how about we do something like that? We say the state bar says, you know what, lawyers, you've done so well. Everybody has to have a certain pro bono. That's where people might call me Pollyanna to think that will happen. But I'm a believer that ought to happen. People like Jeannie, George, myself, we've devoted our lives to working in public service, not making perhaps what we could in another arena. I see no reason that these attorneys I know of who charge $800, $1,000 an hour couldn't devote a part of that in giving back. That, to me, is an example of what we could do.
Okay. And I want to bring Jonathan Simon in here. I'm not sure if you can speak to this question, but the next question is, well, how likely is what Steve Wagstaff says? How achievable is that?
You know, other states that we generally don't want to be compared to, like Alabama, basically rely on the private bar to do this. It's not going to happen. First of all, many of those lawyers that make $800 an hour aren't competent to do a death case. It actually, as I'm sure Steve recognizes, takes a lot of specialized criminal law knowledge that isn't necessarily well distributed in our Tony or law firm. So I just think it's a non-starter. I mean, realistically, if Steve and other DAs want to be realistic with their victims in their counties, they have to tell their folks that when they send somebody to death row, they are sending them to a more comfortable life without parole cell than a cop killer who goes to Pelican Bay. And where is the justification in that? And that's the reality. You can be as Pollyannish as you want about the future, but we've been working on it for 20 years, and it's not going to happen. The other thing is, when we talk about the cost of the death penalty, we tend to focus on the annual expenditures on lawyers, which is real. But, you know, there's also cost in the amount of time our legal system spends on this. Some of the best lawyers in our state, including DAs like Steve, including the members of our California Supreme Court, including the very talented members of our Attorney General's office, which is responsible for a vast area of public policy, not just criminal justice, devote an inordinate amount of their time to the death penalty. And that affects every aspect of business, society, and civil rights in our state that isn't getting the kind of legal time it would get if we weren't clogging our courts up with what's essentially a solvable problem.
And, Steve, do you want to make another comment there?
No, I see the point he makes. I'm not as pessimistic as he is. I know that those big firms could be required to donate some of the money they're making on that. And the other part is other states can get this to go through. And I'm not talking the South. States like Ohio can get their cases to move more quickly through the system. Still a long time. It can be done. There's no reason that it takes what it does.
Okay, 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you'd like to join our conversation tonight here on City Visions at 91.7 KLW San Francisco and KLW.org as we discuss Propositions 34, and now we turn to Proposition 36 with our guest Jeannie Woodford, who's official proponent of Proposition 34 and former warden of San Quentin State Prison, Steve Wagstaff, district attorney for San Mateo, Jonathan Simon, professor of law at UC Berkeley, and George Gascon, district attorney for San Francisco. 415-841-4134. Email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment on our website, klw.org, and search for our program, City Visions, under programs. Okay, so let's turn next to Proposition 36. So I wanted to start with you, District Attorney George Gascon. Tell us about the history of the three strikes law in California and why you feel we need to change it.
Yeah, thank you. You know, three strikes in California started much like, you know, like the revival of Prop 34, the death penalty back during a period of time when there was a great deal of crime, and there was a lot of frustrations with perceived inadequacies in the criminal justice system. And I think that the concept behind three strikes is a good concept, and it's one that Prop 36 seeks to maintain. What we're looking to do is basically say that if you commit a violent crime and you're dangerous to our community, that you will continue to face the possibility of spending the rest of your life in prison. What Prop 36 is doing is saying that the first strike on this sequence of three strikes has to be a violent strike, or alternatively, one of the other two strikes before had to be one where either murder, rape, or another serious offense was involved. But if that was not the case on the first two strikes, and your last strike, as the law currently allows, is a simple strike such as simple possession of drugs for personal use, or, quite frankly, shoplifting with prior convictions of theft, where people are actually being sent to prison for life. And what Prop 36 is saying, you know what, we want to maintain the original intent of three strikes. We want to make sure the violent people will stay in prison. But if your third strike is a nonviolent, non-serious strike, you will be treated as a second striker, meaning that you're still going to be facing a significant penalty. Your penalty will be double, but you will not be facing life in prison. And that's what Prop 36 is trying to achieve. It's trying to achieve a balance between public safety and thoughtfulness. If you look at the way that our current three-strike law works, it's disproportionate and, quite frankly, in some cases unfair, in that you can have somebody committing a shoplifting offense or someone in possession of drugs for personal use, and they can receive a third strike and face a life in prison. Again, much like Prop 34, what we find is that there is no correlation between public safety and this harsh penalty. The reality is that if we turn to states like New York, you know, that does not have three strikes and has had bigger crime reductions in the last couple of decades that we've had in California, we cannot argue with any facts to say that the current configuration of our three strikes is making us safer, because the reality is that it probably isn't. On top of that, there's an economic cost, and the economic cost is pretty significant. And much like there was a case on Prop 34, we're seeing that the legislative analyst is estimating that making the last strike only for violent cases, we would be saving probably somewhere around $70 million in the first few years, and that could go up to about $90 to $100 million in the next couple of decades.
So you're making that fiscal argument as well, and I wanted to double-check on something here. As with Prop 34, where obviously the sentences would all be changed to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole, if Prop 36 were to pass, were the current prisoners who are serving their sentences be able to appeal and have their cases re-evaluated based on the revision of the three strikes law?
That is correct. And there's approximately, we believe that there could be somewhere around 3,000 people, perhaps a little less, that may be able to appeal their current sentence. It would still be up to a local judge in the county where the original sentencing took place to determine that, and certainly the local DA would have the opportunity to argue against it, and it would be then up to the local court to determine whether this person, in fact, should benefit from Prop 36 or should they or not, and continue to stay in prison for the rest of their life.
And so do you know if the Legislative Analyst Office estimate of the $70 to $90 million a year savings took into account the cost to the system of this potential appeal of these 3,000 prisoners?
I believe that it did. And I believe that that savings was predicated on the cost of incarceration of these individuals that are there now that would qualify for appealing under Prop 36, their health costs and some of the other costs associated with maintaining people in prison.
Okay. So what I want to do now, of course, is turn to Steve Wagstaff. You're a member of the California District Attorneys Association, which has gone on the record as opposing Proposition 36. Talk us through the arguments of your organization or the organization you're a member of in their opposition to this ballot measure.
Well, I certainly, first of all, understand what George is saying. It has a lot of common sense to it. And But for the California District Attorneys Association, what has been concluded is that when we're talking of 134,000 people in state prison today, the people who will benefit by this, who will be released, is just 3.5% of all the entire prison population. It's very, very small. And the question is one can say, George can conclude that it doesn't, hasn't done anything to make us safer. And on this one, the state and I personally feel that, no, that's not the case. You know, crime has gone down to its lowest levels in probably, it's about 80 years, the Depression years. And that didn't happen just coincidentally. That didn't just happen out of the blue. And quite candidly, I use as an example, in our county, we had a career criminal prosecution unit that had several prosecutors in it. We had to shut it down in the late 90s because the violent crime was just simply going down in our county. We didn't have that need for it anymore. And so clearly there's something that's caused this crime to go down. There's a lot of forces, but I think this is one we're gambling if we is what would be concluded by the DA's Association doing this. Another point to make is the crimes that are always mentioned are the, you know, the theft or the possession of drugs. Those aren't the only crimes that come under this. It's also that if you have a new crime that involves something such as felony elder abuse or felony spousal abuse, Prop 36 will take those people who are convicted of that under three strikes and will cause them to come under, get the relief of it, and no longer be 25 to life if that's what the judge decides. And in the future, they will not be eligible for it. Additionally, if one of those, it isn't, as was noted by George, that if the person had a prior homicide or prior sexual assault, of course, then they don't get the benefit of this change. However, if their priors are for kidnapping, they can get the benefit of that. That isn't one that does it. So it's really one that sweeps with a broad brush is the position of the DA's Association, and we're taking a chance on endangering public safety. And it really does belong to each county's DA to decide whether to do it. But the DA alone doesn't get the choice. Every single one of these people that was sent up was, number one, the DA sought it, and number two, after conviction, a judge also believed that it was the right way to go, because a judge had the power right at the beginning to say, no, I'm going to not put this person there. What we're really saying is that we need to sweep broadly. In San Mateo County, this initiative, you know, the total number of people in 18 years who will come back under this law to get benefit for us out of the around, I think it's 3,500, I've been told, 13 in San Mateo County. We have used this law very judiciously, and only 13 will be considered. Of those cases that occurred in the last 10 years, one. So it really is, it varies from county to county, and the belief of the DA's Association is that each elected DA in each county should have the right to make their choice that their voters, in electing them, decided ought to be the approach.
District Attorney Gascon, would you like to respond?
Yes. First of all, I agree with Steve that San Mateo County has been very judiciously in the exercise of three strikes. So has San Francisco County. We're probably looking at the possibility of three or four cases, perhaps five, that we may be looking at. But that is not the case across the state. Also, I just want to make a minor observation here. Any third strike that involves a violent act, such as, you know, a spousal assault or assault on the elder as a strike, would still be considered a third strike, and this individual could face life without the possibility of parole if that were the third strike. I think that the problem is with the reduction in crime, and while I agree with Steve, and I have been intimately involved in dealing with crime reductions in the state for many years, the crime has gone down in California significantly. We have seen we have seen greater reductions occur in the state of New York. Very similar demographics, very similar state. And they do not have three strikes. So I think that it's difficult for us to say that three strike has been responsible for the reduction in crime in California, because I believe there are other things at play. But more importantly, and I agree with Steve, we're looking at a very small number of people that actually will be impacted by this, roughly about 3.5% of the population today in our state prison. So the reality is that this is not the people that are impacting the reductions in crime. So taking the same argument, we could say that simply, you know, given that it is such a small number, we should not continue to incarcerate some of those people for life. But the problem is that actually we never know whether it would only impact 3.5% of the population in the future. We just don't know, because the way that the law is currently written, it leaves a great deal of discretion to a district attorney And while I appreciate and I actually admire what San Mateo County has done, and certainly Steve has been very thoughtful in the way that he uses this law, just like we have in our county, the reality is that you could have another DA that comes in, you know, 8 years from now, 12 years from now, when Steve decides to retire. And under the current configuration of the law, you could have shoplifters going to prison for life. And we have seen that happen in other counties. And what we're trying to do is say, you know what, this is too important of a public policy area to just simply say that we're going to leave it up to individuals to decide when they're going to exercise this, because we have seen that it's not exercised uniformly across the state. And we're going to have a different level of influence on the policy at the state level from the people. And the reality is that, you know, if you ask most Californians, they agree that the modification that we're seeking is appropriate, and that the level of discretion that has been allowed to exist today has not worked well in every county.
So I'm going to interrupt you there. Which counties could you point to, if you feel comfortable doing so, that you feel have perhaps not used it with the same discretion as San Francisco and San Mateo?
You know, I think that I would rather just let the voters look at the different counties. I mean, the information is out there. I can tell you that L.A. County, for instance, has been very thoughtful about the exercise of three strikes and their crime reductions. They've been equally as high or perhaps higher than some of the counties that are very aggressive in their exercise of the three strikes. Similarly, you know, in San Mateo County, San Francisco County, certainly in San Jose County in the last few years. So there are a lot of counties that have been very thoughtful and have had crime reductions that are at least equal to, if not greater, some of those other counties that are very aggressive in the exercise of the three strikes.
So Jonathan Simon, to you for a moment, and I know we have a couple of callers waiting, and I will get to you in just a moment, but I just want to make sure these points get made. So Jonathan Simon, what of this assertion that the three strikes law is not being applied with the same judiciousness across the state? And then to Steve Wagstaff's point that, you know, you got to point to three strikes as a major reason for why the crime rate has gone down across the state.
Well, let me take that first. With all due respect to Steve, there's not a criminologist in the state that believes that three strikes can account for the crime decline. First of all, we had a subpar crime decline when you compare us to the rest of the country. And there's also the timing doesn't work. I mean, the implementation of it does not track it. It's simply not it's a dog that doesn't bark. The other point that has to be made is he emphasized the discretion that counties have. Well, it's very nice of county prosecutors and county judges to exercise that discretion to cause state taxpayers to have to pay for it. If you guys want to pay for incapacitating people for life for minor crimes, maybe you ought to do it in your county jail and not in the state prisons where we all have to pay for it. And the final point I'd make is that this is really a big divide now opening up, especially between New York, which has had very, very successful crime reductions by relying on innovative police strategies, and California, which is stuck in the 70s when we believed that police couldn't do anything and only long prison sentences or executions would work. And it's very important now, given the enormous numbers of lives that they have saved in New York and to some extent in L.A., that we try to bring that model all over California.
And to the other point that I made, do you want to...
I'm sorry, would you just restate it briefly?
So the first one that you just mentioned was about... I'm sorry, I just lost...
The crime decline.
The crime decline, yes. I'm sorry, and then the fact that it's being applied differently across the state.
Yeah, you know, you can go online. There's a number of studies. Many of our larger urban counties in Southern California outside of L.A. County are most of the suspects, and a number of other rural counties actually along the eastern side of the state are heavy users of this. I think the thing that your listeners have to realize is that there's sort of two curves you have to pay attention to. One is people's crime careers, and most criminologists believe that no matter how bad your crime career is, most people are really leveling out coming close to zero by their time they're in their 40s. That's also the point at which your health care costs begin to go up phenomenally. And what three strikes, and especially this provision does, the third strike, is take people pretty much at the end of their criminal careers and guarantee that we will pay for their health care at very inflated costs for the rest of their lives. And that's just a bad deal from a public safety point of view.
415-841-4134 or email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Let's go to Shayla on the line. And Shayla, where are you calling from?
Hillsborough, California.
Okay. So, Shayla, would you like to tell us your thoughts or comments on these propositions?
So I did vote early, and I voted against the death penalty and then against the three strikes.
So that means you voted yes on each proposition?
Correct.
Okay. And tell us what your thoughts were.
So I may be even more Pollyanna-ish than the person on your panel, but I really feel that the jurisprudence of the day is pretty barbaric. It focuses on revenge and punishment as justice, as if it's a level playing field, and there's no collective responsibility for why a certain population ends up with crime. And I just feel custodial care and prevention is where the resources should be going to.
Thanks so much for your call, Sheila.
Thank you.
415-841-4134 or feedback at cityvisionsradio.com. Let's go next to Millie. Millie, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Berkeley.
Okay.
And I support Proposition 34, the abolishing of the death penalty, for a very personal reason. I agree with what was just said by the previous caller, but my opposition is this. I cannot imagine being willing to put the noose over someone's head or inject him with the lethal dose or push the button to electrocute him on the electric chair. And I think if you're not willing to do that, you really ought to oppose the death penalty. That's my personal, very personal opposition to it.
Okay, thanks so much, Millie, for your call.
Thank you.
So, Steve, I'll have you speak to Shayla's comments first, that we really should be focusing on rehabilitation and that our system is, as she put it, barbaric.
Well, you know what? That view is one I respect. Shayla's one of my constituents, and I very much respect the view that she has. However, you know, there's another side to this coin that very seldom gets discussed, and that's the victims and what the victims' feelings are, the victims' families' feelings are about this. There are hundreds of them, as Jeannie noted earlier, that support the abolition of the death penalty, and I respect their views. And I've just spoken with so many more who say that they feel that justice for these most evil of killers does call for a punishment higher than any of our others. And one may call it revenge. I don't think of it that way. We simply call it the fair and just punishment for the most evil of acts for these people who do things such as the Night Stalker or John Dunkel, who's been in the news lately. Again, a fellow I convicted 25 years ago of murdering 12-year-old boys, three 12-year-old boys separately. For me, that just fits. But I respect Shayla's view. And that's what I want people to decide it on. If it's wrong, if it's barbaric in their view, then they should vote for its abolition. That's why the basis in which I respect. And if the voters say we don't want it because it's barbaric and all that, well, my job is to enforce the will of the people, and I will respect that. I just want it made on that decision, not otherwise.
415-841-4134. Let's go next to Karen. Karen, where are you calling from?
Yes, I'm calling from Berkeley. And what I wanted to say was that I found out that, let's say somebody's been in jail, they've done a crime, they've been in jail for 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years. When they get out and we expect them to reintegrate into society, they've paid their dues, they've done their time, they are not even eligible or given food stamps to help them out. So it's one thing to give them the death penalty when they're in prison or life in prison for someone maybe that's 18 or 20 years old. But what about when they get out and they're not given any help at all by the state or by the city or the county?
So Karen, I appreciate your point, but I want to direct you to the propositions are saying, you know, in these cases, well, in the case of the death penalty, people wouldn't get out in the first place. And in the second case, we're not sure, depending on how the sentences are revised. How do you feel about the proposition specifically?
Well, I'm not in favor of the death penalty. I'm not. So that's just my own opinion about that. I think that I don't even like life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. I think that should be amended also.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's just my opinion. But sorry about the different question. But
no worries. Thanks so much. Thanks very much for your call, Karen. Okay, and let's go next to Catherine from Sebastopol. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I wanted to talk about the strike system and also the conditions in prison. And I don't know where I should start first, but let's just say I know of an 18-year-old boy that could have been charged with two strikeable offenses for going into a house to steal a piece of electronics. That's a very serious repercussion for a crime. But I do think that the strike system can be heinously severe. And I think in the case where you've got a young 18-year-old boy with two potential strikes is just wrong. And let's just say, yes, it was a crime. It wasn't a violent crime. It didn't involve anyone else. It was a crime. But to have it become so severe is just not right. I don't think the crime fits the punishment. And furthermore, there's nothing in jail that helps these people, mostly men, mostly black men, mostly Hispanics, some of others, of course. But there's no training. There used to be, but they've done away with it. And there used to be, you know, something to kind of help them when they get out. It looks as though they just want to keep them in there and let them, you know, have nothing except for the worst gang situation in the planet is in the jail.
Okay, I'm going to have to.
Unhealthy.
I'm going to have to stop you there, Catherine. Thanks so much for your call. So we have a very few minutes left in our program. Jonathan, I wanted to go to you. What's your thoughts if these two propositions pass? What's the impact on the Bay Area, specifically in the context of realignment?
Well, first of all, if Proposition 34 passes, we're talking about a worldwide impact. I mean, this will be the first time in human history that a population has voted to repeal the death penalty. Legislatures have, courts have, but never a population. So I think this is going to have a big impact globally and on the national debate about the death penalty. In terms of realignment, I think it's really great because the more we can talk about what we actually want to do with the people that are currently in prison or the people we're sentencing, the more we focus our public policy discussion on that, I think we're going to discover there's a lot of exciting solutions. People have talked to your callers about doing better with reentry and with people coming out of jail and prison, doing better with policing. This is a time, I've been looking at criminal justice for 40 years. We haven't had this much optimism and excitement about new innovations in a long time. That's why it's so important that we could clear away some of these policy dilemmas that have been, you know, with us since the 70s. Likewise with three strikes. I think the main criticism I have of this proposition is it doesn't go nearly far enough to deal with many of the problems in the three strikes law. But if we can pass this, it will give, I think, the legislature confidence and perhaps drafters to take a more serious reform and get us more focused on these realignment issues, which is where we'll see the real talent that exists at the county level show itself as counties compete to see who can keep crime lowest while keeping incarceration rates down.
Okay, so I'm going to go to Jeannie, then George Gascon, and then finally Steve Wagstaff. You're going to get the last word. You get 30 seconds each to summarize some key points you want the listeners to leave with.
Well, I want voters to vote yes on Proposition 34 because it really is about public safety. It recognizes that we have a death penalty that's broken beyond repair and that we can utilize the savings by replacing the death penalty to doing what works, and that's putting more police on the street and solving unsolved homicides and unsolved rapes in this state. And that's what makes our neighborhoods and our children safer. Voting yes on Proposition 34 really will improve public safety for all Californians. And so I ask people to support this proposition.
And George Gascon?
Yes, I'm going to speak on behalf of Prop 36. You know, this is really about proportionality and fairness. I'm obviously asking people to vote yes on Prop 36. I think it's unconscionable almost that we can say that we send people to prison for life for a minor offense such as possession of drugs for personal use or shoplifting. I think that we need to think about proportionality. I think that we need to look at it from a public safety stance also and recognize that it doesn't necessarily lower crime. It does not make us safer. And I think if we look at it from an economic point of view, this will be a substantial savings to the state and that might.
Okay, so we got to go to Steve Wagstaff. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'll conclude simply with all three of us, Jeannie, myself, and George, all are looking for public safety. I don't think Prop 34 is what's going to give that to us, and that's why I urge a vote no on 34. But there's one thing for sure. I respect George and Jeannie. We are fighting for public safety.
And that's City Visions for this evening. I would like to thank our guests, Jeannie Woodford and Steve Wagstaff here in the studio, and George Gascon. and Jonathan Simon by phone. To listen to this program again, to listen to previous broadcasts, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to download alerts and podcasts, go to our website, klw.org/program/city-visions. Our engineer this